From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. A new documentary series looks at the campaign of Bobby Kennedy 50 years after his assassination.
You see this politician who made racial and economic equality the cornerstone of what he wanted to communicate. The vision that he had for the country was a hopeful vision, a compassionate vision.
And we meet the winner of NPR's Tiny Desk Contest, Naya Azumi.
I'll play anywhere I'm allowed to play. I don't care if it's one person or 5 million people watching me. I'm still doing the same thing that I'm gonna do anywhere.
All that coming right up.
KPCC supporters include Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy-eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
50 years ago today, Robert F. Kennedy took the stage at the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles to speak to hundreds of supporters. He had just won the California primary as a Democratic nominee for president, and he was about to head to the party's convention in Chicago. Upon leaving the ambassador's stage, he exited through the kitchen, where he was then shot. The next day, his spokesman, Frank Mankiewicz, made this statement to the press.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968.
Kennedy was only 42 years old. Bobby Kennedy for President is a four-part documentary series on Netflix directed by Dawn Porter. Mixing archival footage with new interviews, it tracks Kennedy's evolution as a politician, a public servant, and a man. Here's Dawn Porter.
He gave people a real hope and a real energy that things could be changed. And I think also for marginalized communities, for the Mexican-American, for the African-American, he went into those communities and he spoke to people and he said, I see you, I hear you, and I will represent you and I won't let you down. And he lived up to that, you know, particularly in the later years of his political career. We had the opportunity to spend some time with the busboy, Juan Romero, who was the person who actually cradled Bobby Kennedy in his arms as he lay dying in the floor of the Ambassador Hotel. And one of the things Juan Romero said was, before he met Kennedy, he was a kid who he felt like he didn't have much hope. He didn't feel like he had much direction. And somehow in meeting Kennedy and just having a person that was that important, a person who could become the next president of the United States, look at him, ask him about himself, just spend some time with him. He said, I'd never felt so American. I felt like someone saw me. And I think that Kennedy inspired that kind of devotion.
When you think about all of the footage that you looked at and how Bobby Kennedy was before and after the assassination of his brother, John Kennedy, how would you describe what happened to him? How did he change as a man, as a politician? And what was most noticeable to you?
What was most noticeable to me was, you know, he was very comfortable being the person who kind of blocks and tackles for his older brother, his revered older brother. And by that time, they really had, you know, people have referred to it as almost a co-presidency, but they really had this relationship of absolute trust, although they didn't always agree, but there was a trust there. And John Kennedy's death was devastating for him. He fell into a deep depression. He was not sure what his future held. His whole political life had been in the context of securing the presidency or elected office for his brother. And so after that, he really is at a choice point. Is he going to retreat, or is he going to, for the first time, take the stage for himself? And he decides to do that. He easily could have gone. He could have taught. He had a happy marriage, many children. But he decides that he needs to, at first he needs to carry on his brother's legacy, but then he comes into his own. And as you see him, you know, over the course of the years, come into his own, he's far beyond JFK on civil rights. He turns against the Vietnam War, and he really comes into his own as a person. And I think you see a calmness about him, particularly at the end of his life. He's doing exactly what he was meant to do. And everything, you know, whether good or horrific, has contributed to the politician that he would become.
You look at a number of social issues that Bobby Kennedy really cared about. I want to talk about children and poverty. And this is a clip from Marion Wright Edelman, who is a leading advocate for children. She founded the Children's Defense Fund. And she's talking about Kennedy's transformation after he sees poor children.
Robert Kennedy was not who I thought he was going to be. He was listening and learning. He was also very curious. He didn't talk a whole lot, but he would ask a lot of questions.
Do you know anything about the poverty program?
No, sir.
You ever heard of Head Start?
No,
sir. Nice to see you, everybody.
And I was very moved by how he related to children.
So Kennedy was born into money, and he jokes in the documentary at one point that he doesn't even need to run for office because he's got so much money lying around. How did Kennedy come to see people less fortunate than himself, and why did he care so much about income disparity and poverty?
I think there were a number of factors that contributed to his empathy, and I think that empathy was sincere. One was certainly his religion. He was a very, very devout Catholic, and he took the messages of his church to heart. Another was how important his politics and service, a life of service, was important in his family and was stressed in his family. But I think one of the most significant was his interactions with people who were concerned about marginalized communities, his interactions with Harry Belafonte, with James Baldwin, with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. And those people invited him to come see for himself, to come experience what poverty actually was. And, you know, to their credit, they invited him, and to his credit, he accepted. You know, one of the things I wanted to get across is that this was a process. It was a process for him to evolve. You know, working, seeing Cesar Chavez, seeing Dolores Huerta, listening to his young aide, Peter Edelman, listening to a Marion Wright. And that is something that I think, you know, we can all learn from today, is it's not enough to surround yourself with people who think exactly the way that you do. It's important to be challenged. And then it's important to make up your mind and have a position and then act on it.
KBCC podcasts are supported by Freeform's The Bold Type, produced by Universal Television. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Drama Series, and Freeform's Grown-ish, produced by ABC Signature Studios. Emmy eligible in all categories, including Outstanding Comedy Series, Outstanding Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Yara Shahidi, and Outstanding Contemporary Costumes. Episodes available at Freeform.com, the Freeform app, and Hulu.
50 years ago, the senator from New York was running to be the Democratic nominee for president when he was shot and killed in Los Angeles. That was 5 years after his brother, President John Kennedy, was also killed. And just 2 months prior, in April of 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed in Memphis, Tennessee. That night, Bobby Kennedy delivered the news of King's death to a crowd of stunned supporters in Indiana. We'll pick up my conversation with Don Porter by hearing some of that speech.
Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and distrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. My favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God."
So how would you describe his use of language and his speech making?
Kennedy is one of the most effective and eloquent speakers in American history. And there's a wonderful book by Rick Allen that collects all of these speeches. And that speech is incredibly remarkable. He was advised by his white advisors. So that was in Indianapolis while he was on the presidential campaign tour. And they were quite clear that it was unsafe for him to go. The speech was had been set up by a young advance man named John Lewis, who we know now today as Congressman John Lewis. And they said, the police, we will not send police to protect you. And if you go in there, you know, there will be riots and, you know, we won't be there for your safety. And he turned to John Lewis, who said, people have to hear from you tonight. You have to go. And he listens to this very young aide and he goes. And as John Lewis recounted to us in the interview, he had scribbled a few notes on a piece of paper, but he didn't refer to them. So he not only addressed that audience and told them about this horrific murder, it's the only time that he ever referenced his own brother's death, JFK's death, and talked about how he understood the deep and searing anger that an assassination would cause. But he also appealed to people's sense of justice and of, you know, what people should do in a crisis. And Indianapolis, for a number of reasons, but many people can attribute also as one of the reasons that Indianapolis did not burn that night.
I want to play another clip. It's from Dolores Huerta, and she is talking about campaigning for Kennedy in 1968.
I was put in charge of just setting up all of these rallies up and down the valley.
Cesar Chavez and his colleagues here in California, they really started a revolution, which was a revolution for human dignity.
People wanted to see him win. The only thing is, sometimes we would come back and give our reports, and several people gave this same report, that when they would knock on the doors of some of the older women, they would say, we don't want him to win. Why? Because we weren't going to kill him.
I mean, it's a terrifying idea, because in this era, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, as well as Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. How aware was Bobby Kennedy of how dangerous it was to be someone like him in this time?
I think he was quite aware. You know, most of the people that we spoke to talked about, you know, spoke about the danger. John Lewis in particular spoke about, you know, his, particularly after JFK was assassinated, you know, that he always knew that danger was there. He was not a fatalist. I think he had a lot to live for and he certainly wanted to live. But you know, I think he decided that he really did actually have a calling and that the public needed him. He also decided, you know, tragically, he didn't have that much security. The security that he had was often volunteer, Rosie Grier, Rafer Johnson, professional athletes who volunteered their time. And, you know, I don't think he went into his career unknowingly. But, you know, he didn't let that fear stop him.
We're talking with documentary filmmaker Dawn Porter. Her new series is called Bobby Kennedy for President. I think everybody knows that Bobby Kennedy was shot at the Ambassador Hotel and he died soon thereafter. But I don't think a lot of people, and I put myself in this camp, remember what he said that evening. He had just won the California primary and now he's headed to the Democratic convention. He's likely going to be the nominee against Richard Nixon. So let's listen to a little bit of what he says in this final speech.
Last 3 years, the divisions, the violence, the disenchantment with our society, the divisions, whether it's between blacks and whites, between the poor and the more affluent, or between age groups, or on the war in Vietnam, that we can start to work together. We are a great country and a compassionate country, and I intend to make that my basis for running and over the period of next year.
It is more than a little heartbreaking that 50 years ago, he's talking about the very things that continue to be huge problems for the country today. Given the contentious climate that we live in today, what was it like to go back to that time? And how do you think his message would resonate in 2018?
You know, I keep hearing him saying, we are a compassionate country, and that is the basis that I have for running. And that idea, you know, it was really hard. I have to tell you, we were kind of deep immersed in hundreds of hours of footage. And you see this politician who made racial and economic equality the foundation, the cornerstone of what he wanted to communicate, and you know, the vision that he had for the country was a hopeful vision, a vision, you know, a loving vision, a compassionate vision, and to live in this time where that is the opposite of what we are seeing in politics, it was really, really difficult. But you know, by the same token, I think it was also instructive, you know, and I think when we look to other leaders today who, you know, if we think these are the darkest of times, they're not the darkest of times. They are another in a series of dark times. We recovered from that era, and I think that we will recover from this, but we will not recover if people are on the sidelines. I think it's a lesson in what good leadership is, what that looks like. Leadership matters. Politicians are not interchangeable. But also, I think we as individual citizens, you know, we need to pay attention. And, you know, we can't sit by the sidelines.
There is an amazing show that's closing this week at the Museum of Modern Art in San Francisco. It's called The Train, RFK's Last Journey. And it's photographs that were taken by Paul Fusco from the perspective of the train that's carrying Kennedy's body from New York to Washington. And people are lined up mile after mile, seven and sometimes eight deep, of all different ages and ethnicities, saluting the train, and in a way, I think, saluting Kennedy's life. I want to play a clip of a campaign worker talking about that train trip.
We walked up and down the train, and then starting in New Jersey, maybe Newark, you started to see people were on the train tracks, hanging from the rafters. Nobody had any clue what kind of reaction there was going to be. People inside the train were also overwhelmed by the response of average people. The people that were out there, that was the campaign.
That was the campaign.
This really was one of the most moving parts of the film for me and for the team that put it together, our fabulous editor, Josh Pearson. And, you know, when you see these photos and you see that this was a spontaneous gathering, people once again felt the need to one last time be close to Bobby Kennedy. And they show up, and it's young and old, and people brought their babies. That train ride, I'm told, took, you know, many more hours than it usually would take. And in some ways, you know, people didn't want it to end. That's what John Lewis told us. He said, we didn't want to get off the train because we knew then it would really be over. And to me, like, that was the kind of ultimate way for people to pay respects, but to acknowledge together what really had been lost, the depth of what really had been lost.
Don Porter, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Don Porter's documentary series, Bobby Kennedy for President, is on Netflix now. Up until last month, singer-guitarist Naya Izumi was performing on the streets of L.A. and barely making enough money to pay for rent and food. Now, after winning NPR's Tiny Desk contest, he's playing a string of sold-out shows on his very first tour of the United States. The Frame contributor Stephen Cuevas recently sat in on a rehearsal session with Izumi.
Just one song into a rehearsal at his manager's studio apartment overlooking Echo Park Lake, Naya Izumi abruptly puts down his guitar and slips out the back door to get some air. Kind of overwhelmed right now, he says, just above a whisper. Izumi struggles with mild autism, and it's mostly under control, without medication. But certain circumstances can still overwhelm.
I knew how to handle it. No, I need to leave the room and breathe and count backwards and get my analytical mind back in circuit. then I can push through, even though I still feel stuff. Don't hide your eyes.
Face what you fear. Izumi says music's always been something of a refuge, a focus for a restless mind and an escape from a troubled childhood in Georgia. In addition to guitar, he also mastered the drums, stand-up bass, and pretty much any instrument that appeals to him.
It was a calling towards loving myself, towards being in the moment. I learned so much about life through whatever instrument that I play at. I'm very, very into every single detail. I literally take things apart. All that we have lost
can be restored piece by piece. Much of Izumi's material revolves around fluid, funky, percussive guitar lines. The fingers of both hands often flying up and down the neck of his guitar as if it was a keyboard. His style has drawn comparisons to King Crimson, Prince, and Jeff Buckley, but he's pretty cagey when asked about musical inspiration.
Just sound. I don't play notes. I play feelings. When you listen to sounds and emulate those sounds and feelings, all these senses using your whole body. Percussion especially, you can definitely feel your bones.
Well, it's funny to me, a lot of your music is really percussive. Like, you can feel it.
Yeah.
Over a month ago, Izumi was barely eking out a living, busking on the streets of Venice and Hollywood and downtown LA. But unlike many other street musicians, Izumi writes, records, and performs all his own material. During one burst of creativity in 2016, he released a series of 4-song mini-albums via Bandcamp every month, locking himself away in a small makeshift studio garage in South LA.
I can record a whole song and have it done in like less than a day. Lock myself up and do it. I spend so much time with my music, it's just there when I'm ready for it.
On the strength of this song, Izumi beat out nearly 5,000 other performers to win NPR's annual Tiny Desk Song Contest. It's called Soft Spoken. Don't judge a book by its cover. Soft Spoken was originally written and recorded as Soft Spoken Woman. Izumi says he's struggled with gender identity for years, and a few years ago began the process of transitioning. At a show I saw a couple years ago at a dive bar in LA, Izumi had long black flowing hair, and he wore a long black dress and identified as a woman. Last year, he recorded a video and posted it on YouTube to announce that he was, in his words, detransitioning.
Screw it. It's gonna be hard, but I really want to try to come to terms with my biology. I choose to share my life because I'm a real person. I'm not a faker, and people make things bigger than what they really are. And that's really the whole lesson. It's just be here, love who you are, love what you're doing, love who you're with, and I don't keep all this extra stuff in my head. I'm here, and I'm here.
Now he's a beautiful human being.
Andy Ault started managing Izumi a little over a month ago.
Music flows right through Naya, and Naya has a subtlety, the art of playing guitar. His forearm is holding down a whammy bar, a tremolo, while there's odd signature time tapping, and it's incredibly musical, and there's vocal. That's a dedication that I haven't seen reproduced anywhere else in a human being. I don't care who.
I don't care. We can do that again.
Sure. Do you like that? Like kind of just the ambient kind
of. On the weekend before a mini tour of the US, Izumi runs through a batch of songs with his new bass player, Maddie J, a recent graduate of the Berklee School of Music.
You know, I'm used to communicating with people in the way that we learned from music school through charts or through like, hey, I'm playing this chord and like this is the time signature. But playing with Naya, he just plays and then I listen and it feels so musical rather than having to talk about it.
my whole mentality is to take my music to the next level, is to just play and do it and let myself be found. I'll play anywhere I'm allowed to play. I don't care if there's one person or 5 million people watching me, I'm still doing the same thing that I'm gonna do anywhere. Nobody's gonna stop me from playing.
Since winning NPR's Tiny Desk contest, Izumi's received an avalanche of attention, including an invite from veteran British rocker Peter Frampton asking if Izumi could open for him this summer at the Greek Theater. In the meantime, Izumi will play a string of NPR-sponsored shows across the U.S. through June. For The Frame, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
And that is our show for today. I'm John Horn. We'll be back here tomorrow.